Micah chapter 5.
Now, Micah, as we've learned in earlier weeks, was a prophet who lived 7 centuries before Jesus was born, at the end of the 8th century BC, lived in Jerusalem. And this particular chapter is set very much against our crisis that was looming on the horizon at that time. Micah chapter 5. Let's hear God's word.
Marshal your troops, O city of troops, for a siege is laid against us. They will strike Israel's ruler on the cheek with a rod. But you, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times. Therefore Israel will be abandoned until the time when she who is in labor gives birth, and the rest of his brothers return to join the Israelites. He will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And they will live securely, for then his greatness will reach to the ends of the earth, and he will be their peace. When the Assyrian invades our land and marches through our fortresses, we will raise up against him 7 shepherds, even 8 leaders of men. They will rule the land of Assyria with the sword, the land of Nimrod with drawn sword. He will deliver us from the Assyrian when he invades our land and marches into our borders. The remnant of Jacob will be in the midst of many peoples, like dew from the Lord, like showers on the grass, which do not wait for man or linger for mankind. The remnant of Jacob will be among the nations, in the midst of many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a young lion among flocks of sheep, which mauls and mangles as it goes, and no one can rescue. Your hand will be lifted up in triumph over your enemies, and all your foes will be destroyed. In that day, declares the Lord, I will destroy your horses from among you and demolish your chariots. I will destroy the cities of your land and tear down all your strongholds. I will destroy your witchcraft, and you will no longer cast spells. I will destroy your carved images and your sacred stones from among you. You will no longer bow down to the work of your hands. I will uproot from among you your Asherah poles and demolish your cities. I will take vengeance in anger and wrath upon the nations that have not obeyed me. Would any of us, I wonder, ever heard of Stratford-upon-Avon if it hadn't been for the fact that William Shakespeare was born there? Obscure places sometimes do achieve huge renown, don't they? Simply because they are the birthplace of someone that later history deems to be important. Though it has to be admitted, I think, that usually it works the other way around. An obscure place of birth usually makes the individual who's unfortunate enough to be born there seem rather less interesting or significant somehow by association. In that respect, being born in a second-rate town is a bit like going to a second-rate university. It diminishes your social standing a little. One recalls the response of a rather snooty southerner to the man in the pub who confessed he had been born in Barnsley. Barnsley? He echoed sarcastically. Barnsley? Whatever possessed you to be born in Barnsley? To which the proud Lancastrian replied, I just wanted to be near my mother. Well, I suspect for many of us, if we had lived in the ancient world, Bethlehem would have seemed a bit like Barnsley. Our reading in verse 2, you notice, observes that Bethlehem was politically and geographically quite insignificant. A tiny little village overshadowed by the towering glories of the capital city, Jerusalem, which only lay 5 miles to its north. So small was it, in fact, it seems that you needed to specify not just its own name, Bethlehem, but the local area, Ephrathah, in which it was situated, if you wanted to be sure the postman would find the address.
Today, of course, things are very different, aren't they? Everybody's heard of Bethlehem today. Once obscure, Bethlehem has today become a place of pilgrimage. Tens of thousands of people, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, will make their way there this Christmas time. Because, as the carol reminds us, it was in that little town that Jesus Christ was born. More even than Stratford-upon-Avon, Bethlehem is a place made famous simply by virtue of a single entry in its register of births. Well, this morning, in our study passage, we have a remarkable prophecy. A prophecy which details the location of that unexpected birth, 7 centuries before it happened. And we're going to learn, I hope, a lesson as we study this chapter, which predicts the birthplace of Jesus. We're going to learn a lesson which actually you can find echoed in many other ways and in many other places throughout the whole Bible. The lesson is this: that it often is out of obscurity and weakness and apparent insignificance that God brings forth salvation for the world. Seems to be the kind of way he likes to work. 2 headings for our study. We'll break the chapter in 2 parts. And you'll see, if you've got an NIV, that our translation breaks them at the same point. First, in verses 1 to 5, out of obscurity, a new king arises. And then in verses 6 to 15, hidden in obscurity, a new people arises. Look with me first at the opening paragraph, verses 1 to 5, and this title, Out of Obscurity, a New King. You, Bethlehem Ephrathah, we read in verse 2, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times. I said Bethlehem was famous for a single entry in its birth register. Actually, of course, that isn't quite true. Because even before the birth of Christ, Bethlehem's birth register had already given the town a claim to fame. The history books of Israel record that, something like 1,000 years BC, Bethlehem had been the birthplace of none other than King David. Jews, of course, looked back to the reign of David with the same kind of nostalgia that a very patriotic Brit might look back to the Elizabethan era, or maybe even the days of Queen Victoria. Those were the days of Israel's greatness. It was David's military genius that had defeated the Philistine menace and secured Israel's peace and prosperity in that land. It was David's political acumen that had united those rival tribes of Israel and made them into a centralized and powerful nation. But perhaps most important of all, it was David's personal charisma that had provided the model for monarchy as an institution in Israel. He had stamped his own unique brand of kingship on the Israelite constitution. You see, before his meteoric rise to power, David had been a shepherd boy, tending his father's herds on the fields around Little Bethlehem. This village had for centuries been the ancestral home of his clan. And David never seems to have forgotten the spiritual lessons or lost the humble temperament with which those early rustic roots invested him. David, in fact, became a shepherd king. The word shepherd became a royal title ever afterwards. Unlike the self-seeking tyrants whose cruel and arbitrary governance characterized the surrounding nations, you see, David aspired to be a king who cared. He treated Israel as he used to treat his father's sheep, as a flock that belonged to somebody else. In a very real sense, Israel was not his kingdom. She belonged to a greater sovereign, a sovereign to whom he was accountable, just as he'd been accountable to his father for what happened to those sheep. Sadly, however, if David's reign became the model for Israel's monarchy, it also proved to be the pinnacle of Israel's monarchy.
because nobody in the dynasty which David founded ever came up to his standard in this regard. There were perhaps kings who wielded more political power than David did. There were perhaps kings who enjoyed a greater measure of economic prosperity. But David's successors, well, you see, they were all born in Jerusalem, not in Bethlehem. They were all surrounded from infancy by the privileges of royalty. None of them had ever been a shepherd boy in that modest rural village. And perhaps that's the reason none of them ever ruled with quite the same pastoral heart as David did. Indeed, many of the later kings of Israel proved to be rather oppressive and apostate. Micah, you may recall, if you're following this series, has already given us a rather chilling portrait of some of them back in the opening lines of chapter 3, where he likens the leadership of his country to a pack of carnivorous wild beasts, or even man-eating cannibals. Micah has told us repeatedly that he sees judgment looming on the horizon for his people. And in many respects, this judgment is a judgment upon the failure of her kings. Their failure to live up to this noble heritage which illustrious David had bequeathed to them. And as we enter chapter 5, it seems as though that looming judgment has reached a new and even more urgent stage. For Micah, you notice, begins by announcing, "Marshal your troops. A siege is laid against us." It seems that Jerusalem is being attacked. Her tattered armies have retreated into the city to try and find security behind the city walls, to try to regroup. But it's all going to be to no avail. God intends to leave Israel to reap the harvest of her follies, Micah tells us. She is going, according to verse 3, to be abandoned, at least for a while. And her king, verse 1, is going to be humiliated. They will strike Israel's ruler on the cheek with a rod, he predicts. This is a withering gesture of public contempt calculated to destroy the respect in which a king was held by his court and his people. This is what's going to happen to the king of Israel, he says. Now, some commentators believe these verses are anticipating the fall of Jerusalem and the subsequent exile to Babylon. That, of course, happened, but it didn't happen until more than a century after Micah's death. And it seems to me that the threat of invasion which Micah's describing here is a more immediate one than that. What's more, according to verse 5, you notice, the threat derives most definitely from Assyria, not from Babylon. So in my view, there are very good grounds for locating this chapter, not at the time of the Babylonian conquest at all, but at the time of Sennacherib's invasion of Judah in 701 BC. That happened during the reign of Hezekiah. It was the Assyrians, Sennacherib was an Assyrian general, who did it. Now that was a siege which we know Micah didn't only foresee with the eye of a prophet, he personally lived through that siege. And if that's what's in view here, it does make a difference, I think, to our understanding of what's going on in this chapter. See, it's characteristic of Old Testament prophets to see events of their own day as windows on the future. Prophets didn't receive their visions in a political vacuum. Invariably, they were men who were torn and worried about what was going on in the world around them, and God used those circumstances to generate and to inform their inspired vision of the future. Micah's a case in point. In the final three decades of the 8th century BC, when he lived in Jerusalem, during those 30 years, the military might of Assyria swept through the Middle East, and in its advance, it invaded and completely devastated the once proud kingdom of David. Israel's territory was decimated. Her economy was ruined. Her monarchy was humiliated. Now, as I say all this, Micah not only foresaw, he experienced it firsthand. You just imagine what it must have been like to live in Jerusalem in those days and see this huge military juggernaut of Assyria encamped on your doorstep. That's the situation which seems to be happening as Micah speaks these words. It's the pain of those traumatic days that is galvanizing his prophetic gift. It enables him, you see, to look beyond the horizon of his contemporary world with all its troubles. And to see that God has a plan, actually, for the longer term. There's a lesson for all of us, of course, in that. The reason the Bible speaks to us about the future is not to satisfy our idle curiosity. People who open the Bible, and particularly the prophetic books of the Bible, in order to kind of work out what's going to happen in the future, are misunderstanding what prophecy is all about. The reason the Bible speaks to us about the future is in order to sustain our faith here and now in the present. When we, like Micah, find ourselves besieged, maybe quite literally, by events that are quite overwhelming and quite beyond our control. It's as if God was saying to Micah in this extraordinary situation, look, Micah, the army has retreated into Jerusalem. It hopes that the walls of Jerusalem are going to protect Israel from the final onslaught of the Assyrian army. But actually, hope doesn't lie here in Jerusalem. David's capital city, though it is, impregnable though many believe it to be, hope doesn't lie in Jerusalem. Look over the city wall. You may just be able to see it if you climb on a high tower there, in the distance, to the south. Bethlehem. Yes, hardly noticeable, is it? Tiny little place. Already occupied by the invading Assyrian troops. That's where hope lies, Micah. In Bethlehem, Ephrathah. In the obscurity of that little town. Though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times. Israel will be abandoned until the time when she who is in labor gives birth and the rest of his brothers return to join the Israelites. He will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they will live securely, for then his greatness will reach to the ends of the earth and he will be their peace. The word Ephrathah actually means fertile, and I think it's just possible Micah draws our attention to it because he sees a certain providence in the name. Bethlehem had proven to be a fruitful source of kings once before. And with the insight of a prophet, Micah is foreseeing here a day when, as he puts it metaphorically in verse 3, Bethlehem will once again prove to be a queen mother. She will give birth to another royal son. But what a son he will be. A king who will exceed the ideals of monarchy which great David has established as conspicuously as David's heirs had fallen short of those ideals. Unlike the self-seeking and the predatory politicians that he denounced back in chapter 3, this ruler, he says, will be one who, like David, is a man after God's own heart. He will come forth, he says in verse 2, for me, that is, for God. He will rule, verse 4, in the strength and the majesty of the Lord. What's more, although Micah clearly implies by his reference to the clans of Judah that this king is going to emerge in some way from the dynasty, from the line of David, his language is equally clear that there is a grander and more ancient lineage behind this new king to come. His origins are from of old, from ancient times, we're told. Or as you will see in the NIV margin, the Hebrew there can even bear the force of from eternal days. Notice too the phenomenal extent of this new king's reign in verse 4. His greatness will reach to the ends of the earth, we're told. Not even David's son Solomon could have claimed that. Though the international influence was probably greater in his day than any other time in her history. No, this new king's empire will be universal, says Micah. But perhaps most provocative of all is that poignant sentence in verse 5. He will be their peace. Not as you might expect, he will establish their peace or win their peace. But in his very self, he will be their peace, as if by the very majesty of this utterly unique person, the person he is, this king would guarantee the security and the prosperity, the shalom, the peace of his people. Now, you will find if you read the books that some liberal commentators tend to downplay Micah's extravagant language here. They say it's poetic license. He's obviously believing that the former glories of Israel's monarchy will be to some extent re-established. He's to some extent believing that her international prestige will be restored. But he's exaggerating it all deliberately for effect. He couldn't really imagine that God was going to send a pre-existent, eternal, divine person to conquer the whole world. That's just a preacher's hyperbolic overstatement, they say. But why should Micah not expect the intervention of such a remarkable and unique person into Israel's history? The prophet Isaiah, who was a contemporary of Micah, voices a very similar expectation, you know. He says a baby is going to be born, a baby born of David's royal line from the stem of Jesse, as he puts it. And the names of this baby will include Everlasting Father, Mighty God, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government there will be no end, he says. Is Isaiah engaging in poetic exaggeration also? Well, the fact is that many Jews, certainly many Jews of later generations, took both Isaiah's and Micah's words quite literally. They expected a supernatural Messiah who would rule the whole globe. And of course, most important from our point of view as Christians this morning, that expectation prevailed among many Jews 700 years later. It prevailed when the evangelist Matthew wrote his gospel, for instance. And Matthew quotes these very words of Micah as referring to Jesus. A Jesus who, according to the witness of the New Testament, is most definitely an eternal and a divine figure. Somebody who existed before the worlds were made. And who is destined in the purpose of God to rule the whole universe. So if you set it against that wider biblical background, Micah's language here doesn't need to be regarded as in any way unrealistic. When he speaks of the origins of this king lying in the mists of eternity past and anticipates that his rule is going to embrace the four corners of the earth, he's simply making a statement, admittedly a very early statement, of the messianic hope, which is one of the great unifying themes of the whole Bible. Out of the obscurity of Bethlehem's little town, out of the obscurity of David's faded line, a new king will one day emerge, he says. A great king, an eternal king, a divine king. And poor, besieged Micah finds his confidence in the victory of goodness and in the victory of God sustained by that hope. There is, however, it has to be admitted, one respect in which Micah's words in this chapter do have to be very carefully interpreted. Look at verse 5 and 6. When the Assyrian invades our land, we will raise up against him 7 shepherds, even 8 leaders of men. They will rule the land of Assyria with the sword, the land of Nimrod with drawn sword. He will deliver us from the Assyrian when he invades our land and marches into our borders. So he said earlier, because of the contemporary military crisis Micah and his people are personally facing, he sets this great messianic hope, which he has prophetic insight, against the backcloth of the imminent Assyrian conquest. There are some commentators, you will read, who fail to make sufficient allowance for the effect of that upon the form this prophecy takes. If liberal scholars sometimes tend to downplay the degree of literalness that should be applied to a passage like this one, you'll find there are some very conservative commentators who insist upon such a high degree of literalness, they feel compelled to argue that Micah's words here still await fulfillment. For they say the military triumph over Assyria, which he speaks of here in verses 5 and 6, simply didn't happen. Israel never conquered Assyria. Quite the contrary. so these conservative commentators insist, since that conquest must still be on God's timetable, no word of prophecy can fall, it must be on the timetable for the future. In some millennial age, which has yet to dawn, they argue, Israel is going to become the most politically powerful nation on earth. And during that millennial age, Israel will conquer all her ancient foes, just as prophecies like this one anticipate. Of course, those foes are known to us now by new names, like Iran and Iraq. But geographically, these modern nations occupy the territory once occupied by Assyria and Babylonia. So these scholars argue the only way Bible prophecy can be literally fulfilled is if there is some huge military conflict in the Middle East at some point in the future. In fact, some of them are so confident of their interpretations in this regard, they're prepared to paint very detailed and often somewhat lurid pictures of the events of the last years of human history. And invariably they see the repatriation of Israel, which has taken place in our century, and the current turmoil in Middle Eastern politics, as is in our newspapers almost every day. Invariably they see these things as significant in this respect. Old Testament prophecy is about to be fulfilled, they claim. Jesus is going to shortly return and commence his millennial reign on earth, and then all that Micah describes here by way of military conquest in the Middle East will take place precisely as he has described it, with Jesus wielding the sword. Well, I have to say, I hold many of the scholars who take this interpretive line in great respect. They are more accomplished in their scholarship and more godly in their Christian lives than I am. But I can't really preach this passage to you this morning without confessing to you that I really don't share their point of view on this particular matter. God may very well have some future purposes for the nation of Israel, but I honestly don't believe these verses in Micah demand it. There may very well be more military conflict in the Middle East in the future, but I honestly don't believe these verses in Micah are predicting it. What Micah is doing here, as we said at the start, is characteristic of all the Old Testament prophets. Under the inspiration of God's Spirit, he is using the traumatic events of his own day as a window by which to gain insight into God's more distant plans. Inevitably, his vision of those plans is coloured by the particular details of the political and military crisis he was facing. It's only when we turn to the New Testament that we're given the clues that enable us to understand how we are to interpret verses like 5 and 6 here of Micah chapter 5. For according to the New Testament, God's plans did not work out quite as Micah himself imagined. We do not need to await the arrival of some millennial age or of some future huge military conflict for the fulfillment of Micah's vision here. The New Testament is convinced that fulfillment has occurred. It occurred 2,000 years ago, and it occurred just where Micah said it would occur, in the little town of Bethlehem. But that brings me to the second half of our study passage, remember? Not just out of obscurity a new king, but hidden in obscurity also a new people. Look at verses 7 and 8. The remnant of Jacob will be in the midst of many peoples. And notice in verse 8, he repeats exactly the same phrase. The remnant of Jacob will be among the nations in the midst of many peoples. Throughout this chapter, if you study it carefully, you'll find there's a rather interesting oscillation between single and plural pronouns. Sometimes Micah clearly has an individual saviour in mind, the Messiah who we've just been speaking about. He will stand and shepherd his flock, singular. But at other points, Micah equally clearly has a community rather than just a single individual in mind. I mean, look back to that odd phrase in verse 3, for instance. What do you make of that rather strange reference to the rest of Messiah's brothers returning to join the Israelites? Who are these brothers? In what sense do they return? Or look again at verse 5. Who are these seven, or is it eight,
shepherds who will govern Assyria? And who are the we who we're told in verse 5 will raise up these shepherds? I suppose one of our literalist friends might speculate that these seven represent Prime Minister Netanyahu's cabinet. Or perhaps the generals of the Israeli army. Perhaps they would go on to argue that Nimrod in verse 6 is a pseudonym for Saddam Hussein. Once again, I have to say I don't think so. The attempts to relate passages like this to the politics of the late 20th century are just wrong-headed. What Micah is foreseeing here, within his own terms of reference, 8 centuries before Christ, in the wake of the Assyrian conquest, is the future triumph of the messianic kingdom of Jesus Christ. He's describing that triumph in terms that make sense to him and to his own people within that highly politicized environment in which he lived, with Sennacherib and the Assyrian army quite literally parked at the gates of Jerusalem. And as a result, it is easy to make the mistake of thinking that when the Messiah comes, it's going to be to wage a military campaign in the Middle East. That was, in fact, the very mistake which the contemporaries of Jesus made. It was a major reason they found it difficult to believe in Jesus. Because, in fact, Jesus did not wield a sword. His strategy, instead, was to establish a community. That was his tactic. Not to form an army, but to call a small company of disciples. This community would indeed conquer the world, but not in the way that many a zealot nationalist of the first century, or indeed many a Zionist extremist of the 20th century, would like to believe. And if you read the second half of chapter 5 carefully, I think you'll see that Micah himself has been given by God a very remarkable insight here into the nature and role of that messianic community that shall be. He calls them in verse 3 the brothers of the Messiah. He calls them in verse 7 and verse 8 the remnant of Jacob. In the New Testament, of course, we call this community the church. The 7, or is it 8, under-shepherds that he mentions in verses 5 and 6 are rulers of this new community. They represent, in other words, what we would call church leaders. And the victory they win, though it's couched in military terms here by Micah, the New Testament will tell us is actually a spiritual and a moral victory. It's the victory of which the Apostle Paul speaks when he writes to the Corinthians. We demolish enemy strongholds, he says, but not by using the weapons of the world. No, the sword which New Testament under-shepherds of Christ must wield is the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. Now, the thing I want you to really notice is where Micah locates this new community, which he sees emerging along with the Messiah. It is, he says in verse 7, in the midst of many. Notice he repeats that again in verse 8. The remnant of Jacob will be among the nations, in the midst of many peoples. It's clearly an important phrase. It suggests to me that Micah does not think of this messianic community as a nation state within political borders. He thinks of them rather as a kind of dispersed, intermingled community, seasoning the whole world among the nations in the midst of many peoples. Which, of course, is exactly how Jesus anticipated his disciples would be. You are the salt of the earth, he said, the light of the world. You're to spread out and intermingle with this world, in it, though not of it. Remember the parable he told of the seed of the wheat, which was sown, but also among the seed of the tares. Wheat and tares together. You couldn't disentangle them, he said, at least not this side of the end of the world. They were intermingled. Micah anticipates two effects arising from the ministry of this messianic community in the world. And he juxtaposes, you'll notice, two metaphors to describe it. In verse 7, he likens the church, the community of the Messiah, to dew. The remnant of Jacob will be like dew from the Lord, like showers on the grass, which do not wait for man or linger for mankind. Dew or showers, this is a word picture which is always positive in the Old Testament. Micah seems to be anticipating here the spiritual and the moral benefits, the spiritual and the moral health, which the presence of Christians, the messianic community, is going to bring in secular society, in the nations, among the peoples where they are mingled. He says such health can't be organized by human politicians. It can't be produced by public education. It can't be purchased by economic affluence. Just like the dew, says Micah, the extent of this positive influence on society depends wholly on the grace of God. It does not linger for mankind. For a while, maybe, society enjoys such benefits. But then, like the dew, it vanishes. God takes it away. And society is left once more to experience instead the unmoderated consequences of its antagonism to God and its sin. In that situation, says Micah, turning to his second metaphor in verse 8, the messianic community, the remnant of Jacob among the nations, becomes not life-giving dew, but a ravaging lion. A lion which mauls and mangles as it goes and no one can rescue. In other words, the church has a ministry of judgment as well as salvation within the world. That perhaps is a word of particular relevance to us today. It's very easy in a place like Britain, with a long Christian heritage, to think that you can somehow Christianize civilization. That if the gospel has a sufficient impact on a society, you can somehow institutionalize that impact, preserve it, contain it, guarantee it for the future. In a way, we've tried to do that in this country. We've established the church. We've allowed, in many respects, Bible religion, the Christian faith, to influence our constitution, our laws, our politics. In so many ways. You can see in our traditions the influence of that dew of the church sprinkled in the history of our nation. Too easily we forget that it is dew. And dew does not wait for man or linger for mankind. You cannot actually Christianize civilization. You can't institutionalize the positive benefits of the Christian community within the world. God will never let you do that. The dew will disappear. And once it goes, judgment will come. Just as if it had never been there. You can no more institutionalize the Christian church within the secular world than you can design a reservoir to trap the dew of heaven. The relationship between the Christian community, the community of God's Messiah, and the world, therefore, is always going to be an ambiguous one, a slightly awkward one. For in a very real sense, this messianic community will never really belong in the world. Though they are in the midst of many peoples, they never really belong to those people. In it, as we said, but not of it. Loving the world, but in another way hating it. Saving the world, but in another way judging it. That's the way it is. In his helpful little commentary on Micah, Bruce Waltke draws attention to, again, some words of Paul from 2 Corinthians in this connection. Thanks be to God, Paul writes in 2 Corinthians. He always leads us Christian preachers in triumphal procession, in victory. And then he goes on, to the perishing, we bring the smell of death. But to those who are being saved, we are the fragrance of life. It's precisely that dual effect that Micah seems to be anticipating here. One way or another, he says, God will ultimately destroy all his enemies. Those enemies who are resolute in their determination to oppose his rule, he will destroy in judgment. Verse 9, your hand will be lifted up in triumph over enemies, and all your foes will be destroyed. But there is another possibility. Those who repentantly accept the call to join his people, who are, as he says in verse 3, joined to the brothers of the Messiah. They return, or you could actually translate that word return in verse 3, converted. They are converted to join God's people. Those who are joined to the Messiah's flock, in them, Micah says God has a different kind of destructive work to do. Notice how he outlines it in our final paragraph, verse 10. In that day, declares the Lord, I will destroy your horses from among you and demolish your chariots. I will destroy the cities of your land and tear down all your strongholds. I will destroy your witchcraft and you will no longer cast spells. I will destroy your carved images and your sacred stones from among you and you will no longer bow down to the work of your hands. I will uproot from among you your Asherah poles and demolish your cities. See, Micah there is fastening upon three evidences of the spiritual declension which he could observe among the people of his day. First, he said, they put their trust in military hardware, what he calls horses and chariots and strongholds and cities. Secondly, he says, they engaged in occultism and magic, what he calls witchcraft and casting spells. And thirdly, he says, they practiced idolatry, worshipping carved images and Asherah poles. All three are examples of how a secular society, a godless society, a faithless society, tries to control its destiny, tries to protect its prosperity. With our military hardware, with our attempts to manipulate forces that are greater than us, through witchcraft or through idolatry in the ancient world. There is actually a timeless relevance about these three things. They all reflect our arrogant human confidence in our own ability to achieve our own security. Mike is clear that the new community which the Messiah will establish shall have learned the folly and the futility of that kind of self-reliance. God will destroy, he says, their horses and their chariots, their carved images and their witchcraft, all those things. The retributive hand of God in their case is going to operate not to destroy the sinner, but to change the sinner by a chastening discipline, to destroy the sinner's sin. As Sennacherib's siege, you see, shattered the complacency of proud Jerusalem, so Micah sees the remnant of Jacob learning to throw its faith onto the Lord, rather than on its military hardware or its occultism and magic or its idols. And this, of course, is the lesson God is always seeking to teach the world. This is the lesson which the Bible says will ultimately determine our judgment. What do we put our trust in? Do we put our trust in our military hardware? Do we put our trust in our technology and science? Do we put our trust in the products of our own imaginations and the work of our own hands? Or are we prepared to put our trust in the God who made us? Do we see ourselves as creatures, noble and godlike in many respects, but creatures nevertheless, creatures whose destiny is to fulfill the purpose of the one who made them? Or do we seek to usurp the role of creator for ourselves and determine our own destiny? That's the crunch issue. And make no mistake about it, insists Micah, one way or another, God is going to assert his sovereign prerogative over this world. It is his world, and he's not going to permit us indefinitely to live as if it was our world. We are creatures, not creators. We are tenants of this good earth, not its owners. And those who challenge God's property rights, he is going to judge. One way or another, he says, God will destroy his enemies. Verse 15, I will take vengeance in anger and wrath upon the nations that have not obeyed me. He will punish disobedience wherever he finds it then, whether in the pagan tyrannies of the world, like Assyria, or within nations that have been favored by biblical revelation, like Israel, or even within the church of Jesus Christ itself. Whatever our spiritual privileges or lack of them, he must either destroy our sin, or he must destroy us. And the question which Michael 5 seems tacitly to put us quite simply is, which shall it be? Shall he destroy our sin, or shall he destroy us? Which community shall we join? The enemies of this new king, or the brothers of this new king? Shall the witness of the Church of Jesus Christ, hidden as it is among the nations of the world, prove to be in our case a life-giving dew, or a death-dealing lion? Shall this messianic king that is born of David's ancient stock be our savior or our judge? For one or the other he must be. He will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, predicts Micah. The trouble is, of course, our image of a shepherd is altogether too soft and sentimental, isn't it? The word shepherd conjures images for us of a gentle-eyed old man cuddling an orphan lamb. David, of course, knew better than that. So did those shepherds on the hills around Bethlehem on the first Christmas night. Real Oriental shepherds are tough. They have to fight off wild beasts that threaten their flocks. Sometimes they have to use the whip and the goad to get their recalcitrant sheep to go where they want, where they're meant to go. So when we read that Jesus said, I am the good shepherd, don't interpret him to mean, I am a soft touch. Don't think when Jesus says, I am the good shepherd, he means, I am a pusillanimous weakling. Don't think he means, I am an incorrigible sentimentalist. No, when Jesus said, I am the good shepherd, what he meant was, I am a king. I am a king like David. But greater even than David, of even more noble pedigree than David. And that's why, of course, his birth in Bethlehem is so riddled with irony. For who would have thought to look there for the future sovereign of the universe? The evangelist Matthew, of course, tells us a small party of wise men did look there. Almost certainly they came from Persia, territory that 700 years earlier had been part of the Assyrian Empire. They came, Matthew tells us, looking for the one who had been born king of the Jews. Remarkably, a star had led them. But as it turned out, it was not in fact the star that proved crucial to the success of their search. It was these very words of Micah that guided them, of all places, to that little town of Bethlehem. In his great poem, The Journey of the Magi, T.S. Eliot suggests that after that epic pilgrimage to Bethlehem, those wise men were never quite the same again. And I'm sure he must be right about that. For whether as life-giving dew or as a death-dealing lion, those who meet this Messiah and his people are always changed by the encounter. The security of the godless fortresses from which those wise men from the east must have come
the effectiveness of the godless science, which was their stock in trade, the power of the man-made idols, which had for centuries defined their pagan culture. Now, this meeting with the infant Jesus must have placed a huge question mark over all of that for them. What was it that ancient prophecy had said about him? He will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they will live securely, for then his greatness will reach to the ends of the earth, and he will be their peace. I guess besieged and battered by things that often seem to overwhelm us, we could all do with a little peace. Micah would tell us where to find it. Yes, if we're seeking peace today, we shall find it in Bethlehem. Always in Bethlehem. Not in proud, palatial Jerusalem. Always we are more likely to find this shepherd king, this Jesus who brings peace to the world. Always we are more likely to find him surrounded by peasants than by plutocrats. More likely to meet him in a simple home than a royal palace. More likely to meet him in obscure Bethlehem than in royal Jerusalem. More likely to meet him, dare I say it, in a chapel than a cathedral this Christmas. Maybe even a chapel like this one. Let's pray together.